Willkommen beim Bete Bora Podcast. Bete Bora ist ein europäisches Netzwerk jüdischer Frauen. Wir verstehen uns als Plattform für internationalen feministischen Gedankenaustausch. Wir sprechen mit jüdischen Frauen über ihre Ideen, ihre Ziele, ihre Tätigkeiten und ihre Errungenschaften. Damit wollen wir Frauen besser sichtbar machen und ihre Position stärken. In der Gesellschaft im Allgemeinen und in der jüdischen Welt.
Hello, my name is Barbara Breinsack. I'm happy to welcome you to today's episode of Bete Bora, which takes place in the home of our guest, Carmel Shalev, in the north of Israel. If you hear sounds in the background, it might be Storm Barbara. It might also be Carmel's non-human companions in the form of a wonderful dog and a cat with the angelic name Angel and a less angelic character. So if you hear things in the background, this is what it is. I will introduce our guest in a second. Before that, I will remind everyone that Bete Bora is a platform for the exchange of ideas among Jewish women, with the aim of bringing together women with different approaches to life, different approaches to living a Jewish life and being in the world. And also a platform that tries to foster debate and exchange. Our guest today, Carmel Shalev, covers quite a bit of that breadth herself in her life. She has done an amazing range of things and experiences. I met Carmel about 20 years ago when I interviewed her as a health policy expert. And Carmel, this is something that she covers in a new and forthcoming book, studied law at Yale University. She was actually the first person studying and writing about surrogacy before it was practiced and before it was covered in a range of other books, papers, and podcasts. She has also been very active in the peace movement in Israel. And Carmel published a book in 2020 with the title of In Praise of Aging, published by Watkins. We will make sure to have a link to the book included in our show notes. So it's difficult to know where to start, Carmel. I took a peek into your new book where you talk about your years in Yale as a feminist young scholar and a mother of a young child. But before we get there, let's start with the latest book that you published, In Praise of Aging. So aging is usually not something that people praise. So I've got two questions for you. What made you write a book on aging? And why do you think that aging deserves praise?
Thank you, Barbara, and I'm very happy to be here. I wrote this book because after I retired from my professional life as an academic, I was part of a movement in Israel called Wisdom of Aging, which is... Over the course of about 5 years, we convened small groups once or twice or three times a week. And we talked about our experiences of aging from the perspective of the Dharma, which is the teachings of the person whose name was Gautama, known as the Buddha. Gautama was actually a historical figure. And his teachings are full of practical wisdom. And during the course of those 5 years, I was also, while I was sharing, I was studying aging in the view of the Dharma. And why write about aging and in praise of aging? Because we live in a time of anti-aging. We also live in a time where some people predict that we might live for 250 years or beat death. But Gotama taught us something very simple. We are all born, we all grow, we all fall ill, we all age, and we all die. And our very existence is impermanent and conditional. And the horror of this coming to an end makes us suppress it. And in the same way, we suppress our aging experience. I don't feel 69 years old. I learned this from my mother. When she was already suffering from dementia, it was her birthday, she was turning 87, and I said to her, Mom, it's your birthday tomorrow. And she said, oh, yes. And I said, yes. And I said, do you know how old you are? And she paused for a moment, and she thought, and then she said, 27. So I learned a lot about aging from my parents. I also learned about the social construction of aging, which I do not want to take part in, because there are social forces that structure our experiences of aging. We talked about this earlier, for example. In Israel, a major experience of aging is grandparenthood, much as motherhood is a major experience of women in Israel to this day. And there is like this script that, okay, now you're retired, go enjoy yourself on cruises to Iceland or wherever, and go and see matinee films on Tuesday for half the price. And yeah, take care of your grandkids and do everything you can to fight aging, including all the cosmetic surgeries so that I cannot accept the fact that this body is.
Let me try to tease two things apart. You said on the one hand, retirees are expected to go off and enjoy themselves. So age is associated with leisure and joyful experiences and maybe even adventure. And then at the same time, you say that accurately, in my view, there is a negative connotation of aging. It's often described as decline. And I don't need to convince any of our listeners. I think that aging is not something that most people celebrate, unless this is the example of your mom, right? Somebody who forgets, maybe also forgets that the social expectation is that she isn't happy about aging. But so how does this go together? The ideal of the happy pensioner going on new adventures and also the pejorative connotation of aging.
Yes, well, for me, pleasure is not the purpose of my being here on the planet. You know, what gives meaning? Having a good time, I have nothing about having a good time. But it's not enough, not for me now. It isn't enough.
No, but my question was more geared towards asking, is the expectation or the invitation of people to go and enjoy themselves not a challenge to the observation of yours that aging is something that is stigmatized and is...
Well, I must comment that this is a privileged generation.
Mm-hmm.
I think I belong to a privileged generation, the post-World War II generation. I was born in the 50s. And I think our childhood was a very sheltered and innocent one. And our old age is also a very comfortable one. And it seems that the forecast for the future is that we might be the last generation to enjoy that privilege of comfort. We have the economic security of pensions and whatever. And I doubt that this will continue down the road. But there is also the anti-aging is also the denial of the aging is also because there is social prejudice against old people.
Mm-hmm.
There is social prejudice. And you experience it in the way, you experience it, it's very subtle. It's like people who suffer discrimination because of their color or their ethnic origin, or women who suffer a different demeaning attitude. It's very, very, very subtle. But there is social prejudice against aging. And I want to be able still to give in many ways to society and not just to retreat into a bubble and enjoy myself.
Mm-hmm. You talked about, we could call it a script of aging for women in Israel, in other countries, that you described as going from motherhood to grandmotherhood. Tell us more about the script and how you experience it and how it might affect women who do not fit that script.
Well, of course, it's not black and white, because there are many women my age and older who are very much engaged in whatever they are gifted for. But I am, for example, I personally am not a grandmother. And it is very unusual. Almost all of my friends, they might spend some of their time having a good time. They might spend some of their time continuing to work professionally to a certain degree or another. But most of them also have grandchildren in their lives. And of course, actually, there is huge benefit to intergenerational activity. And I think it's very important to build frameworks where older people can mingle with younger people. I heard today that Beyonce was awarded something. She has made an unprecedented record. I have to confess, I don't really know who she is, but there was a story of a 5-year-old child who heard her song, and that was it. This is 20 years ago, mind you. But yes, we need connection. And part of the modernization of the world has been the splitting up of families. I think that 100 years ago, people used to live in much closer proximity to families and to communities where they were involved with different generations. And I think that part of the, what you call the atomization of the lives that we live today in the world is that loss of intergenerational contact. So for people who have it, because of their own families. And, you know, I have an aunt who has, oh God, how many great-grandchildren. But for me, you know, as you know, I wrote about surrogacy. For me personally, childbirth was never a goal in itself. It seemed to me that this is not the exclusive essence of women, that, okay, childbirth can be part of my life. It isn't necessarily part of my life. It doesn't have to be part of my life. There is something more to me as a human being than being able to reproduce. So on the one hand, I see in my own family, especially the religious side of the family, my own sister has over 20 grandchildren. And it gives them a lot of joy. It does. But there must be more meaning to my being on this planet than to bear offspring.
You, interestingly, when you talked about something enriching out of intergenerational activity, as you called it, this could be possible also in communities that aren't necessarily defined by kin, right?
Yes, we have a beautiful, just this week, a beautiful initiative. I live in a village in the Western Galilee. And a beautiful initiative started of matching families who do not have grandparents living nearby with the older people in the community who do not have their children and grandchildren living nearby. And I think it's a wonderful way of creating a community of people who care for each other.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about the atomization of society, the dissolution of this, or the retreat of this intergenerational activity, then we can think of multiple ways in which this could come into being. And the idea that in this script that you mentioned, it's mostly through blood relations that this can take place, also includes a particular, it includes traditions, it includes practices that people are used to, but it also includes ideology, right? When I think of your...
Well, you know, Israel's culture is very family-oriented. You know, when I watch films from the USA, for example, I'm always astounded at how that, you know, you have people in all sorts of dramatic incidents and they don't have family around them. Israel has a very strong family culture. You know, people spend time with their family every single weekend. In the United States, when I was studying, students used to go back to visit their parents once a year on Thanksgiving. That was all. So in Israel, this, I think that the atomization is felt actually less.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, the script of grandparenthood is much more compelling.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that probably in other countries where the family is not such a strong social institution, yes, there is very much need to bring together the older people and the younger people in the community.
And when that is not done, then it leads to loneliness and other effects that we know and that make people ill. Yeah,
well, there are many causes of loneliness, especially for older people in society today. And yes, and I think that the distance from family and the weakening of the family is one of those instances. And of course, a family can be very oppressive. You know, well, we might often want to be free of our families, to find ourselves. But yes, I think that one of the possible things that we can do to relieve the isolation and loneliness of old people in the communities is create frameworks where they can come together with young children and young adults and learn from each other. I mean, for example, I could really do with a teenager with computer skills. I could really do with that, yeah.
How does aging affect women differently from men in your environment, in your...
Well, you know, on the one hand, women have much greater skills of adaptation than men. Men seem to be single-minded, so when they lose their jobs, that's it. And women reinvent themselves in multiple ways. On the other hand, women, the old age is actually, statistically, an issue for women because women live, on average, 4 years longer than men. Their life expectancy is, on average, 4 years greater than that of men. So essentially, the most vulnerable of the older people in our societies are women. And then, of course, men have the women who support them in their illness and old age, And then women are left alone. They don't have, statistically speaking, of course. And there is, you know, despite the fact that equality for women was proclaimed in the mid 20th century, and I really myself embraced that and benefited from it. But the mindsets, the patriarchal mindsets, are very, very, very deep. And of course, there is still bias against women rather than men.
Carmel, you describe yourself as a feminist. When was the first time that you thought of yourself as a feminist?
I'm not sure I can answer that question. I can tell you what event it was that made me into a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
I was then serving doing my military service. I was on a kibbutz. It was a religious kibbutz. And it was the 9th of Av. And there was a basti, it was south of Jerusalem. And there was a bus taking us into the Western Wall. It was a Saturday night, and I was wearing the dress that I'd worn a year earlier, the day I was recruited. And it had short sleeves, but it was also a mini dress. It was above the knees, which was the fashion at the time. And I was not allowed onto the bus because my clothes were not modest enough. This was a very charismatic figure in the village, and he became a politician later. His name was Hanan Porat. He was one of the first nationalist religious politicians. And at that time, I sort of realized also that if I were a boy, I would go to yeshiva and become a rabbi. And I expressed this to him, and he sent me to the wife of a rabbi. The rabbi's name is Tzvi Tau. He has lately been in the news for his very, very, very extreme, messianic, ultra-religious, fundamentalist views, whatever. She was a convert. She was born in Holland, and she was a convert. And I was sent to her to study with her. She was this very, very pale, gaunt figure, colorless, and dressed in black and gray, and very modest house, very modest living room. And I sat there and I looked at her and I said, I do not want to be like her. And it took me about 7 years to actually work through the process of becoming secular. But I think that that was the formative moment of my feminism, not being allowed on the bus because my skirt was too short.
So years later, you went to Yale and you studied law there, and you studied surrogacy, which is I think it can't be more, not more feminine topics as affecting women in so many ways than surrogacy. And you were, as I mentioned initially, the first person writing about this. How did you end up with this topic? And how have the Yale years shaped your thinking and your feminism and your womanhood?
Yeah, well, I came to surrogacy through abortion. I myself had an illegal abortion in my first marriage. I've been married twice. In my first marriage, I had just started studying at the university. Yeah, I hadn't gotten to law yet. I was trying physics and math. Wasn't too good at that. And I got pregnant, and it was, and I was still living a religious, observant life. And it was clear as day to me that I was not ready to become a mother. And I walked up to the university health clinic. I was living on campus in married students' dorms. And I walked up the hill and I walked into the clinic and I said, I need an abortion. And the woman behind the counter said, shh, she put a finger to her lips. Shh, come here. I didn't even know it was illegal. And that you can't speak about it in public. It was very easily done, despite the fact that I... But as a result, I was referred to a private doctor. She was a woman, actually, a gynecologist. And it was very straightforward and simple. And but then I transferred to law. And when it came, I wrote a seminar paper on abortion, because it was during the years that abortion was being legalized to a certain extent. And I wrote my master's thesis on that as well at the Hebrew University.
Did you tell your friends and your family about your abortion in those days?
I didn't even tell my mother. Mm-hmm. And my mother sensed and she called. Mm-hmm. And I just said, I'm not feeling well, because I was at home for 2 days in bed. No, I did not share it. No.
Did you ever tell them?
No. Mm-hmm. No. No. And that's how, and then when I got to Yale, I had my first year was again to get another master's degree, was taking courses. And I was trying to figure out what I would like to do. And one idea that I had was, because abortion involved the right to privacy, for example, in the US, as we know from the recent Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade, which said that women's right to abortion was protected by a constitutional right to privacy. And so privacy was just the beginning of artificial intelligence, of the computer. I didn't even have a computer then. I wrote my thesis on a typewriter, my dissertation.
What year was that?
In 1982. And then it was like, oh, no, that's too big for me, all this information privacy, that's too big for me. I'm going back to solid ground. And even when I was having in my research on abortion, I'd already seen the trends in reproductive technology and in the medicalization of reproduction. So I took up surrogacy.
And you wrote a book about it?
And I wrote a book about it called Birth Power, mm-hmm. The Case for Surrogacy. And it is true that women as surrogate mothers have been exploited horribly, especially in transnational practices. But in Israel, there is a law that allows surrogacy. That's also a story that I was involved in. I actually resigned from a position in the government as a legal advisor because we had a commission that recommended a law on surrogacy. And then the health minister told me, oh, I've been to the rabbis and they demand this and that. It cannot be a married woman, for example. And it cannot be the egg of the surrogate, for example. And I resigned over that. But
you resigned over the restrictive approach?
Yeah. But in fact, the practice of surrogacy in Israel has developed in a very interesting way. And the most beautiful thing is that I have two nieces, sisters, daughters of my own sister, who have both been surrogates. And after the rabbis allowed married women, because when it was only single women, it was really quite problematic. But when it's married women who are also allowed to be surrogates, it's not a simple experience at all. It is a very complex relationship, but it can be done out of, for both of my nieces, out of a sense of wanting to give an infertile couple, a child. And their experiences, as complex as they were very beautiful. Each of them had a different experience. But really, it is a beautiful gift. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you raised your daughter who you gave birth to, we should say. You raised her partly when you were in the US and then you came back to Israel with your daughter, who is a very, very, very good career and is a very accomplished person in her own right.
And now you define yourself as a writer. So you're still involved in debates on health policy, on bioethics, on politics in the widest sense of the word, and you define yourself as a writer. You are at an age, and I can say that because you mentioned it, that some people would consider not super young. So what, also I'm asking this in a particular context of political change, what is it that you as a feminist, as a writer, as a mother, as an Israeli, what is the thing that you want to achieve? We talked about giving back. Okay. What do you want to achieve in the next years?
Okay. Well, one thing is, why do I write? So the book that I'm currently working on towards the end is about my experience at Yale, because I chose a very womanly subject. Can you imagine? Yale Law School in the 80s, surrogate motherhood. Where does that come from? And I thought that my job was to get on with my job, and I got on with my job, and I wrote a feminist thesis about regulating surrogacy and, yes, giving value to women's labor from an ethic of care and responsibility, a la Carol Gilligan, okay, in a different voice, now finding women's voice. It wasn't selling babies. It was, there is value to the labor that I am investing to bring this child into the world for you. I'm not selling a baby. It's the value of my work, my labor, my care. I got into trouble for various reasons. I was very politically naive and inept, and I got into trouble, changed various supervisors. I now hear that it's not so unusual. And yet I persevered. And in the end, I was actually awarded my doctoral degree in a public ceremony. But 2 weeks later, I was told it had been revoked. And this was absolutely devastating to me. It was a public shaming because I had already told people that I had the degree, and now I had to tell them no, and I was told to form a new committee and rewrite it, which I did, and eventually I was awarded the degree that I deserved from the very start. But it was obvious that it was because of the subject that I had chosen and the approach that I had chosen as a feminist, as an early feminist. This was really the year after they revoked my degree. The same faculty refused to allow Catherine MacKinnon, who was a graduate of Yale Law School, they refused to allow her to be there as a visiting professor. So, again, it was a very conservative institution. But what happened to me was that I felt that I had been stigmatized as a feminist troublemaker. And I think that together with my ineptitude in academic politics, I carried this stigma with me all the way. And so writing this book is sort of a way of healing that scar and also sharing with women of this generation that, yes, we thought that we'd become liberated overnight, but no, a lot was going on before Me Too when we didn't talk about it too much. And I'm pretty sure that there are other women like me who had similar experiences that it's difficult to actually put a finger on, but that were obstructed in their paths in the world because of conservative men who wanted to preserve their position of power.
Carmel, thank you very much. For our listeners who are interested in reading your new book, when might it be available?
Oh, gosh. We don't even have a title yet. We had a title until 5 minutes ago, but then...
we should mention that just before recording this podcast, we were exchanging title suggestions. But it will be... I took a peek, and it will be a really, really interesting and fascinating book.
Hopefully I'll be able to find a publisher within a year.
So we will share it on the website when Carmel Shalev's book is available.
Carmel, thank you so much.
Can I just say something? Because you did ask about, you know, what's going on now, and I know that we don't want to get into politics, but I must say that Israel, women's situation in Israel as equal is rather precarious. And it's becoming even more so during these days where we're going through a kind of constitutional regime crisis. And let's just pray that the trends towards segregation and exclusion of women and control of women by rabbis will be stalled.
Mm-hmm. I join you, Carmel, in this hope. Thank you again very much for talking to us today and for giving us insights into your work and in your life. And thank you everyone who has been listening. Please check out Carmel's work, which we will include in the show notes. And we look forward to hearing and seeing you again next time. Thank you very much.
Wenn Sie weiterhin unsere Podcasts hören wollen, dann abonnieren Sie uns bitte. Sie können auch über unsere Website direkt zu unserem Podcast-Kanal einsteigen. Auf Wiederhören in einem Monat.